All right, we're in Nehemiah chapter 13, which is the last chapter in this book, and we are ready to start verse 15. So we're really beginning now the second half of the chapter, and the first half was really centered on a particular issue that also involved some other issues. So yes, we can say it was more than one, but it was all related in this situation where the people of Israel here in Nehemiah's time, which is also Ezra's time, he's there also. So the Lord has two of his servants doing much work. Ezra the priest was teaching the people his word. Nehemiah had been has held the position of governor, which equates to the former position of old before the kings of what the judges were. We remember the Lord had said that after the kingdom of Judah fell, of course, the northern kingdom of Israel fell more than a century before the southern kingdom of Judah fell. The Lord had foretold that when that those events happened, that he would restore a remnant of them to the land of Israel, and he would give them judges as at the beginning. They no longer have a king. So under the judges, even though that's not the title here, the title under the Persian government for the leader in Israel is the governor. The Tershatha, as we've seen the official title from the Persian government that Nehemiah held. So with the authorization of the Persian government, but of course, who was the one that chose Nehemiah to be their leader? It was the Lord. Who was the first of the governors of Israel after the exile in Babylon? Zerubbabel, who was the son of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel was the son of Jehoiachin, also known as Jeconiah or Coniah, who was the king of Judah, the last in terms of generations, even though his uncle Zedekiah was the last king of Judah chronologically, but the last generation to serve as kings of Judah was Jehoiachin, who was the grandson of Josiah, but Zerubbabel was his grandson. And Jehoiachin was held as a captive in Babylon for the remainder of the time of the Empire of Babylon and ate at the king's table there. Eventually was removed, released from prison, and was held a chief position eating at the king's table in Babylon, but that was Jehoiachin. His grandson, Zerubbabel, becomes the leader of Israel, but not as a restoration of a physical kingdom. What did the Lord say about Coniah's, Jehoiachin's descendants prospering on the throne of Judah in Jerusalem? Would that happen anymore? He said no. So when his grandson Zerubbabel returns with the captives, with the authority of the Persian government under Cyrus at that time, well, he's their leader, their governor. He's not serving as a king. But who chose him? He was a righteous man, very righteous man. Well, the Lord chose Zerubbabel. Now he's chosen Nehemiah, but with these leaders the Lord is choosing for them now, I mean, is it based in their who they are in terms of family or inheriting the position like a king? Not at all. The Lord is choosing these righteous leaders for them. Isn't that what he did under the judges? I mean, this is that system again. So we see Nehemiah in that system. So whether the Lord called them the judges under that period of what we refer to as the judges, well, the Lord refers to it as that, But how is this really functionally any different, what we're seeing now? It's really not. It's gone back to that system the Lord had in place before, which is what he said he would do. Is this for the good of his people? We're seeing that. How many of the kings of Israel, how many of the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom, would have done any of this work that Nehemiah is doing, or what Zerubbabel did before him? They were all wicked, 19 of them, all were wicked. Now, the kingdom of Judah, they also had 19 kings. How many of them were fully righteous? There were only four of them. Now, we're not talking about the entire kingdom of Israel, which, of course, David and Solomon were righteous, but after the kingdom split, there was Asa, Jehoshaphat, Hezekiah, and Josiah. Those were the only four that were fully righteous. Now, there were some who started out well, but then turned away, and a number of them fit that pattern. There was at least one in the case of Manasseh who was fully wicked, and then he repented and turned to the Lord. He was really in a class by himself as far as that is concerned, there were quite a few, especially the ones that had connection to the house of Ahab, that were fully wicked all the way through. But how many were righteous and walked in the ways of David, with the Lord describing them like that? Only four kings of Judah, David and Solomon. So out of, when you add up, 41 total kings reigned from when Saul first became the first king of Israel. There were 41 Israelites who served as kings. And of 41, how many were righteous? 6 out of 41. That's not a very good percentage, is it? Now, what was the percentage of the judges that were righteous? Which judge do we read about where the Lord says this was a wicked judge that he put in? Didn't happen. In one case, when there were no righteous men that the Lord could put in the position, what did he do with Deborah? He put in a righteous woman in that case. That was to the shame of the men of Israel. But, I mean, the Lord gave them a righteous judge. So that was 100%. Well, with these governors, we're seeing that pattern again. That was for the spiritual good of Israel. I mean, what happened to Israel spiritually under the kings? Did they prosper, or did it lead to their turning away from God? It led to them turning away from God. I mean, for the northern kingdom with the 10 tribes that were given to Jeroboam, who was Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. I mean, that's how he's described repeatedly in the scriptures. I mean, he led that whole kingdom, those tribes, away from the Lord. That was the case for with the tribe of Judah, who had Benjamin with them, but under the vast majority of their kings also. So we would not have seen many of the kings that ever lived that would have done the work that we're reading about here that Nehemiah is doing, or the work that Zerubbabel did that we saw in the previous book, the book of Ezra, that we read about in the first half of that book. I mean, Zerubbabel led them back in the rebuilding of the temple, and they were serving the Lord fully. Well, they turned away after his time. The Lord's given them Nehemiah now, along with Ezra's work, who started 13 years before Nehemiah's arrival, but his work as a priest in teaching God's word and organizing the priests to do that, that was helping to lead the people back to God. But this work that we're reading about with Nehemiah, he has the authority to do these things that he's doing here, but because he is a righteous servant of God and loves the Lord with all of his heart and soul and mind and strength, he's taking the actions that he is. In this last chapter, the book of Nehemiah is going through a series of these situations, these spiritual issues that were there that Nehemiah, in his position with the authority that he held, God putting him there, choosing him because of the heart that he had, and we see the actions that he's taking as in that position the Lord had given him with that authority. This is a great example for us as we were attempting to make that connection last week, but we have that opportunity here again this morning and through the duration of our study of this chapter, but to look at these Nehemiah particularly as an example of how a righteous person will exercise God-given authority. Well, there's no authority that exists that is not from the Lord. I mean, who has all authority in heaven and in earth? I mean, it's Christ. The Father has given that to his Son. So the Father is working all things after the counsel of his will through Christ. And now, did the Father put himself under, when he gave Christ all authority, did he put himself under his Son's authority that he had given him? No. But is the Son following his Father's will and direction and everything? And the Father is doing that through his Son. It has pleased him that in Christ his Son that all fullness would dwell, as he tells us in Colossians 1. And he's given him a name which is above every name, as we're told also in Philippians 2, 9 through 11. Authority above all authority. Matthew 28, 18, Jesus has all authority in heaven and in earth. And that was given to him when the Father raised him from the dead. That's that inheritance that was prophesied in Psalms 2, Psalm 110, a number of others. But that was all in keeping with the Lord's plans and what he had foretold that he would do in giving his Son that authority when he raised him from the dead. So if there is any authority today, who is it under? It's under Christ from the Father. If it's outside of his authority, then is it authority? It would be a usurpation of authority. We would be usurping if we've not received that authority from God through his Son. Well, there's a number of different ways in which the Lord uses his authority, and does Christ, with the authority given to him by his Father, give authority to others on this earth in certain positions? He does. What about the government? Is that under his authority or outside of it? It's under his authority. So the powers that be are ordained of God, Romans 13, 1. Does the Most High rule in the kingdoms of men? He does today as he always has. And he has all dominion. And so governmental authority, and we read in Romans 13 when he talks about law enforcement officials, when he speaks about tax collecting authority. I mean, all of those government functions as authority to enforce the law. I mean, that's is everybody a willingly obedient to the laws of the land to submit to them, to be orderly and follow that? No. If the Lord didn't exercise that authority through his officials, what would we have out here? It would be bedlam. It would be absolute bedlam. How would we be able to live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty if there was no structure, if there was no authority, no guidance or rules, and those that would enforce those rules? We couldn't. How could the gospel be spread and prosper in utter chaos? Would that suit the Lord's purposes for his children and for others to become his children? That would not be in keeping with that. And so the Lord has provided that that authority and the enforcement of it. I mean, if there were rules but no enforcement, what would happen? It would just be on paper, we would have that chaos, that it would be anarchy. That would not be a good thing. So there has to be law enforcement. There has to be the rules, the ordinances, and those that enforce them. I mean, how many people would turn over their taxes and pay that without being forced to? And so there are these government officials, and in Romans 13, what he calls them, the Lord's ministers. They're serving him. Do they have to understand and believe that they are for them to be doing that? Right. How many understand that they are occupying the position that they have granted by the Lord, and that they're to use that authority, seek to use it in accordance with the will of the one who's given to them that? How many of them have that understanding and are seeking to do it in that way? Yes, very, very few, if any. And I mean, we would... Is there any that even acknowledge that? And a few do. Is that a good thing? That's a good thing. But is it necessary for the Lord, for that to be the case, for the Lord to use them to exercise his authority? I mean, how much, when did the Lord put Nebuchadnezzar in his position? When he was teaching that lesson in Daniel 4, when did he put Nebuchadnezzar in his position as the head of gold, as that ruler over Babylon? Well, when he became that, who was the one that made his kingdom to prosper so he became that great tree in the branches of whom that's where everyone dwelt and the Lord used to provide for all under that tree? I mean, who made him that tree? Who gave him that kind of authority and made his kingdom so vast and powerful? Well, God did, and God told him so, but did Nebuchadnezzar see it that way? Is that how he understood it or believed it? I mean, when he was walking through his palace, was he contemplating the greatness of God and all that God had done through him? Or was he contemplating his own greatness, thinking he was the one that did it all himself? And which was the moment when the Lord drove him from his kingdom, from the position he'd given him, until he learned the lesson, which he did. And then he extolled the Most High, and he acknowledged God and being the one who gave him that position. But did he have to acknowledge that before God was using him in the way that he decided to? When you read Isaiah 10, and we're reading about the Assyrian rulers that the Lord used as a rod to punish his own people, the Lord was using him as a saw, as a tool in his hand, a rod, a saw, an axe, all of that. Did the Assyrian rulers recognize that they were that tool in the hand of God? Or did they fully believe, did those kings fully believe they did this all themselves? And they had a very stout heart. They were very proud. That was the case, and that's the case with most. Who gave Pilate his authority that he could make the ultimate determination of whether Christ was crucified or not? He said, when Jesus was silent before him, "Don't you know that I had this power, the power of life and death over you?" And what did Jesus say? And he would not have any were it not so. Did Pilate understand and believe that? They don't have to know it or believe it for it to be true, and for the Lord to use them anyway. And that's the way it is in almost every case. Now, any that are acknowledging who gave it to them, that is a good thing. And if they're seeking to use it in a godly manner, that's a very good blessing. But there are very few that have that understanding and faith. But it doesn't change the fact that God's put them in the position as using them. I mean, how many police officers understand that they are operating as a minister of Christ to exercise his lordship over the earth? Not many, but they are. So that's the Lord's authority. Well, the authority in the home with the father and the mother over the children too. Those positions that the husband and father has, and also that the mother has in the home, is that of men or is that from God? And it also, there's authority in the church that either elders have or the men of the congregation. Did the Lord organize that? Is that from him? What about authority, if there's authority in a work situation, which there always is. There's always a boss, and there's bosses and all of that, but there's authority structure and everything. But even in that, where does that come from? And does God teach us as a Christian in any position of authority how to use that authority in the Lord's manner righteously? Yes. Well, this is an example of it. Nehemiah was doing that. And if we, in whatever way in life or time in our lives or situations in which we have authority in any way, we need to use that authority in accordance with the Lord's will. Nehemiah is an excellent example of that. The first half of the chapter, what we saw was the situation where they had allowed Moabites and Ammonites into their midst, two in particular, with Sanballat and Tobiah, who were the chief enemies of the Israelites. There were others, and so they heard that commandment of the Lord at the beginning of the chapter, and the people then removed them from their midst. But who had been the chief leader in that particular sin? Well, it was their own high priest Eliashib, who had his son marry the daughter of Sanballat, and then with Tobiah, who was a Moabite, but Tobiah, who's an Ammonite, he gave these rooms that were part of the temple that were supposed to be used to put the tithes, and he gave those rooms to this Ammonite, who was their enemy, to use right there in Jerusalem of the Lord's temple. I mean, what kind of an abomination was that? I mean, in multiple levels. But it also, I mean, not only was there disobeying God's direct commandment not to have, in that case, an Ammonite in the congregation. Not only was he in the congregation, but he's taking control of these rooms of the temple. Well, that's an abomination, but then when he's using them, they're not being used for the purpose that they were there for, which was for the tithes, to provide for the priests and Levites so that they could do their work for the Lord and then have their physical provisions. So when those rooms are used, not used for God's purpose, for this wicked Gentile who was an Ammonite, then what's happening as far as the tithes and being used and distributed as the Lord had commanded? That can't be done, and it was being neglected. And so then they're not doing the Lord's work because they're having to fend for themselves so they can eat. What did Nehemiah do about it? Well, he ejected Tobiah from the rooms, had the rooms cleansed, purified, and then used in the proper way, organized with faithful men to distribute the tithes, and then the people were giving as they were supposed to. So this was not only getting rid of a wicked man from the congregation and from the occupying rooms of the temple, but it was also, he was also at the same time making sure that God's work could be done, that the priests and Levites would be able to do what the Lord had given them their positions for, which is what was the entire purpose of the tithes. And so that section ended in verse 14 with Nehemiah's plea to God for the Lord to remember him for it. Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and wipe not out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for the office offices thereof. Well, that was his request of the Lord there honored and heard? Yes, and obviously it's being remembered. The Lord preserved that. Remember the when the woman used that costly ointment to anoint Jesus' feet, that was the situation when Judas spoke up and then got the other apostles to dissemble. Well, that should have been sold and given to the poor. Judas was thinking about the money he could have stolen from if it had been sold off, because he kept the bag. And so then the other apostles were thinking, yeah, that would have been right to give to the poor. They weren't thinking like the thief was, but they were thinking with compassionate hearts. That would have been a better use for it. But what better use would there have been for that than to anoint the Lord? And what did God say about that? What did Jesus, his son, say in regard to that work that she did? Yeah, it was going to be preserved and recorded and be remembered always. And there it is. We read about it in the Gospels and the New Testament. So what she did continues to be read about by any who read God's word all the way to the present time, 2,000 years later. Well, this is 2,400 years or a little more in this case from what Nehemiah did here. And we're still reading about his deeds. So the Lord has remembered them. But most importantly, not just remembering for it to be remembered by, I mean, it's one thing. God has given him a great honor to preserve his works as an example for his followers for the rest of time. I mean, that's a great honor. But more than that, of course, what's going to happen with Nehemiah as far as the judgment to come? Is he going to be rewarded by the Lord in eternity for that? All of those works, and we're going to see that with each of these situations. Nehemiah makes that same plea, and God has heard that. But we also see his motivation. He's asking the Lord to remember the good that he did, and what did he do it for? He says, my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for the offices thereof. So who was he doing all of this for? Was it because he enjoyed the power to be able to do it? He was exercising that authority God gave him to do the Lord's will. He was doing it for God. Well, there's the example. That's the right thing to do. And any authority we have, we need to understand who gave it to us, and then to use it in the way that the Lord has instructed for his purposes, not for our own or any other reason. But there was his motivation. He had a righteous heart and was seeking to do what was good for the Lord. Now, with that, did he lack any zeal, or did he lack any courage or boldness in that? I mean, that authority had to be used for the Lord, and if he had it and didn't use it, and he rebuked these other rulers there, remember in verse 11, the ones who had been there in his absence when he had to go back to Persia for several years. And it's when he came back and, well, he mentions his astonishment at that, or describes how he felt about that when he came and found out about it in verse 8. It grieved him sore. I mean, he goes away for a few years, comes back, and these ones who had been the chief enemies that he had had to oppose in the rebuilding of the walls, the ones that had done all that they could to stop that work, he goes away for a few years and comes back, and then he finds the high priest has married his son to the daughter of one of them, and then the other one, he's given the rooms in the temple that's supposed to be going for the tithes for the Lord's priests and the Levites to do the Lord's work, which is now being forsaken because of it. What? Can you imagine when he comes back and finds out about that? I mean, it says it grieved him sore. But was there, when he left, did that mean there was nobody left behind to look after things in his absence? They were there, and there were rulers that are described there in verse 11. But what had they done? What had they done with their authority? They hadn't used it. They did not use that to, certainly they weren't using it for the Lord. They did nothing to stop this evil. So if we have authority and there's evil going on and we don't use that authority to stop the evil, then are we going to answer for that? Then we'd answer to God for that. But Nehemiah is not going to have to answer to God for that. He had the authority and he used it, and so he got rid of Tobiah, and then organized the distribution of the tithes. So now the priests and Levites can do the Lord's work like God intended. Now, what was, how did, and we don't have a mention right here of Eliashib's reaction to it. Obviously, Tobiah was a very chief man among Gentile people. I don't think we have to use much imagination as to what Tobiah thought of Nehemiah's actions, but what was the likely feeling that Eliashib had? Did he have shame on him? With Nehemiah's action, did that expose his own shame in this? When he's done these actions, the Nehemiah's, why are you allowing this to go on and then completely goes against what the high priest is doing? I mean, he's opposing the high priest and everything that he's doing right there. It's unlikely that Eliashib would have felt very very good about what Nehemiah was doing, but I mean, was Nehemiah going to be, was he fearful of the reaction that the high priest might have? Well, if I do this, he's going to get really mad at me. I could have a lot of trouble somehow. There's no apparent thought for that at all. He was going to do what was right in the sight of the Lord, and did he care what the evildoers were going to think about that? No. All right, so then verse 15, we start to read about another situation, Nehemiah 13. Verse 15, he says, "In those days saw I in Judah some treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves and lading asses, as also wine, grapes, and figs, and all manner of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals. There dwelt men of Tyre also therein, which brought fish and all manner of ware, and sold on the Sabbath unto the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah and said unto them, What evil thing is this that you do and profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers thus, and did not our God bring all this evil on us, upon us, and upon this city? Yet you being you bring more wrath upon Israel by profaning the Sabbath. And it came to pass that when the gates of Jerusalem began to be dark before the Sabbath, I commanded that the gates should be shut and charged that they should not be opened till after the Sabbath. And some of my servants said at the gates that there should no burden be brought in on the Sabbath day. So the merchants and sellers of all kind of ware lodged without Jerusalem once or twice. Then I testified against them and said unto them, why lodge you about the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. From that time forth came they no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves and that they should come and keep the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. Remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of thy mercy. All right, so here's this next situation that we read about. They were profaning the Sabbath day. They were doing so in a number of ways here. So first of all, here they are treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves and those burdens of all those different goods, the wines, grapes, figs, and all of that, all manner of burdens, he said. They're bringing it in on the Sabbath day. And they're selling that. Well, whose business is that? What's that?
Their
own business. I mean, how's that different than any other day as far as doing those works? Whose works were those? God's or theirs? That theirs. That's where the problem is. All right, well, we go back to the book of Exodus. Now, what in the book of Exodus, where do we first read about the Sabbath? Now, of course, it's Moses goes to Mount Sinai and gets the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, and then the Lord gives him not just ten, but on the tables of stone, 10, but the rest of the law, which is far more than that. But one of the 10 was to remember the Sabbath day and to keep it holy. That's not the first time we read about the Sabbath and keeping it holy, though, when it was given in that commandment. What was to come as far as that law, we see the principle established a few chapters before in Exodus 16, with the gathering of the manna. And so the Lord made, he made the manna to fall. And what does the word manna mean? What is it? Yeah, so the what is it fell 6 days a week. The Lord made it to fall on every day but the Sabbath. And so they were to gather on those days in which the manna fell. And so they were given instructions about that in Exodus chapter 16. If we go to verse 15, it says, when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, it is manna, for they wist not what it was. They didn't know what it was, so they called it, what is it? Which is what the word manna means. And Moses said unto them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. So there's the actual answer to the question there. The bread which God had given them to eat. Verse 16 says, this is the thing which the Lord hath commanded. Gather it of every man according to his eating, an omer for every man according to the number of your persons. Take you every man for them which are in his tents. And the children of Israel did so and gathered some more, some less. And when they did meet it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. They gathered every man according to his eating. By the way, that principle is, that right there is quoted in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 concerning the distribution of the collection to the ones who had need when that was taken up by the church. So that principle of providing what was needed by ones for to assist them. But with the manna, that's how it was done. So everybody had what they needed. Verse 19, and Moses said, let no man leave it till the morning. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses. Isn't that always what happened? Shouldn't that have been enough, since Moses was speaking for whom? For God. So if Moses gave them instructions, should they have had to have had some consequence for not listening to it before they said, oh yeah, we better do what he said there? Why didn't they just do it because God said to do it through him, through Moses? Man, that's just not the heart of this people, this generation, is it? So we're just seeing another example of that here. So Moses said, don't leave it till the morning, but they didn't listen. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses, but some of them left it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank, and Moses was wroth with them. So God had to make something bad happen, bring a consequence on them so that they understood they needed to obey that commandment. But if God said don't leave it till the morning, then what are they supposed to do or not do? Don't leave it till the morning. Why should they? They tested everything, didn't they? They won't even. How difficult is that instruction? They won't even do that. And then they had to bear a consequence there. So, I mean, imagine what poor Moses, 40 years of dealing with that people. Anyway, verse 21 says, and they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating. And when the sun waxed hot, it melted. And it came to pass that on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for one man. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said unto them, this is that which the Lord hath said. Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that which you will bake today, and see that you will seethe, and that which remaineth over lay up for you to be kept until the morning. And they laid it up till the morning, as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither was there any worm therein. And Moses said, eat that today, for today is it Sabbath unto the Lord. Today you shall not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, in it shall there be none. So that was the Lord's instruction there. So God made the manna fall on 6 days and didn't make it fall on the seventh day. So that he arranged that so they wouldn't have to do that particular job of gathering and preparing and all of that on that particular day. All right, what does the word Sabbath mean? It really means to cease, to stop. Did it mean everything? Now, they came up with all of their own, especially the Pharisees, by the time we get to Christ's time on the earth, they had a whole slew of their rules and regulations regarding the Sabbath based in their utter misunderstanding of God and his word. But they ended up having their own commandments and traditions out of it, which was without understanding. And, of course, multiple times accused Jesus of sin because he wasn't following their traditions and commandments. This ceasing, what did it mean? Well, let's read before we close here. Let's go to Exodus chapter 20 and look at verses 8 through 11, where he gave the commandment to the people. He said, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But on the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor the stranger that is within thy gates. This, For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Well, it's actually very clear there in verse 9. 6 days you will labor and do all your work. So that seventh day, they were to cease, that they were to stop from their own work. Did that mean that they were supposed to? Was that the great nap day in Israel? No, that was not. Well, it may have been in practice, but that's not what the Lord intended from that. They were to stop from their own works. What were they supposed to do? That was a day to be used to do the Lord's work. So that was a day reserved for His purposes. And we have many other scriptures on that we want to look at. And that's something to ponder between now and next week as we're out of time. But I'd like to also recommend reading Isaiah 58, where the Lord describes His fast and the Sabbath day is mentioned there, as well as what Jesus said about the Sabbath when he was wrongly accused of violating it, when he was doing what was good in the sight of God, serving his Father, doing good works for the Lord, for his Father on the Sabbath day. So all of that is going to show how the Sabbath day was a day that they were supposed to be doing good works for the Lord. Well, doing your buying and selling, all of the business, is that the Lord? They could have no doubt rationalized or tried to justify that and somehow turn that into the Lord's work, but it wasn't. So they were doing business as usual there in Israel on the Sabbath day, having their buying and selling and carrying in their burdens and doing all of that. They were doing that on the Sabbath. And how were they treating that any differently than any other day of the week for that? That's what they were doing all the other days. So they were absolutely breaking the Sabbath. Nehemiah set that right. But we'll look at that some more, Lord willing, next week. But let's close by going again to our Heavenly Father in prayer.